You are listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Kirin's The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
Chapter 43.
"Follow, Manet," cried Deliani as she was being dragged away. "Can anyone hear me? Can anyone help?"
No response came. Something clung to her wrist so tightly it caused her pain. At first she was simply hauled by whatever thing it was, but soon she gained her footing and was able to keep up by walking and running, always trailing her captor, and the pain in her arm eased when she was on her feet. She tried several times to resist and pull free, but whatever was clutching her was too strong and unyielding, and she gave in and followed helplessly through total darkness. She could only hope Manet was coming, but had no way of knowing. She assumed the passageway they were taking was the same she and Manet traversed on their way toward the water, ancient torches on the walls. As they moved steadily along, it was obvious that escape from this being wouldn't be easy, and her hand was becoming numb from the pressure. To her surprise, though they were moving faster than she and Manet had, she wasn't colliding with walls or the ceiling. They were marching unimpeded, as though her leader knew precisely where everything was and could avoid it. Or was it possible nothing was there to collide with? Could it be, she wondered, we are in a hall so spacious we would not encounter anything? As they progressed farther and farther, she discounted that possibility. No underground arena could be this large. It would dwarf even the Shillito cave. There was some other explanation. She thought back to what happened in the water. Could this abductor be the being that lowered the cord to rescue me? That was in darkness, yet my benefactor found me, and with only my head above water, not by chance. How could anyone have found me there? Unless, is it possible, it can see in the dark? If so, or it has another way of sensing things, it might be leading me through tunnel after tunnel without hitting a thing. Again thinking of Manet, she turned and called.
Follow, Manet, follow!
With no way of knowing whether the bird was there, she was forced to move at a steady pace. It went on for a long while and what seemed a great distance, during which she heard nothing from her unknown companion. On several occasions, she asked in Ruvan and her home dialect where they were, why she was being taken, who was taking her, and where they were going. No response came. The pull on her wrist remained intense and firm, and she sensed no opportunity for escape. Escape to what? She asked herself. Gloom and a maze of corridors? She almost laughed and noticed she was less frantic than she'd have expected. Because of exhaustion, the trials she had been through, and because she half suspected this was the creature who saved her life, in a strange way, it was a relief to be in the company of another being, though she had no idea who or what it was. Eventually, her companion slowed, then came to a halt, greatly appreciated by the flagging Kirin. For a while, nothing happened. Not a sound could be heard. The grasp on her wrist was released, and she rubbed her hand until the circulation returned. Calling again for Manet, she heard no sound from the island and worried about where she might be, what fate had befallen her. Standing for some time in solid blackness and hearing nothing from her abductor, she became aware of a musty smell she couldn't identify, except that it might be coming from something old. All at once came a series of low grunts and mutterings, the meaning of which, if any existed, she couldn't decipher. Before this, she assumed only one being was present. Now, to her growing discomfort, it seemed more than one were there, and a guttural conversation was unfolding. Holding her breath, she heard shuffling and movement nearby, then all was quiet. But now the smell was strong. Something was near, but she couldn't judge in what direction until warm breath was on her left cheek, then her neck. To her dismay, she was being sniffed again. She shivered and cringed, but made no attempt to escape. There was nowhere to go. "Something is merely investigating me," she assured herself, her anxiety rising and heart pounding. The sniffing was brief, and the presence seemed to recede. Another exchange of low murmurings came, this time from farther away. A period of silence was followed by more shuffling. Both her wrists were grasped, and she was pulled forward in the darkness. She did her best to stay upright and keep her footing, but they, she assumed there were more than one, were traveling faster than before. Occasionally she faltered, but never fell, tiring more and more the longer the trek went on. "Whoever or whatever they are," she thought, "they're anything but slow afoot and wasting no time." Suddenly they stopped. Her wrists were released and her captors seemed to move away. Then she heard a chinking sound as if a chisel were being tapped against rock. Next came a grating, as though stone were sliding over stone. Finally, a resounding crash reverberated throughout the space. The brave Kieran flinched and crouched at the unexpected, harsh noise, but something also came that brought relief. In her lowest moments, she had given up hope of seeing light again. But there it was, ahead of her, coming from what source she couldn't tell, even as she strained to see. Nor did she care it was light. Under other circumstances, it would have been the palest of light. But here she shaded her eyes and turned away from its dazzle. Standing up and looking at her murky surroundings, she could see rocky walls dimly, and also what had made the reverberating sound. Lying on the floor of what seemed a tunnel was a sizable piece of stone, debris scattered around. Cautiously approaching, she saw that the light came through the ceiling, through a hole created when the stone fell, dust still rising in dim rays filtering from above. Her eyes adjusting to the light, she glanced about again. It wasn't a tunnel, but a cave with a low ceiling and dim entrances to tunnels on all sides. Then, at a distance, she saw the outlines of two creatures, one, she assumed, her abductor. They started moving toward her, and she backed away, but realized she had nowhere to go, and stopped some distance from the light. "At least I'll be able to see them," she thought, "whatever they are." She had an idea. The light might be from the sun, and this opening could lead to the outside world. Moving under the hole, she raised her arms and tried to touch the interior edges, but they were just out of reach. Jumping, she could touch them, and she jumped repeatedly, grasping and clawing at the smooth, flinty surfaces, but could get no hold. The two creatures continued approaching, and she gave up and backed away. When she retreated, the beings stopped, and she strained to see what she was dealing with, but could make out only obscure outlines. Neither she nor the others moved, and she was beginning to feel more uneasy about their intentions when one shuffled forward and stopped under the hole. With rays illuminating it from above, she saw it in its entirety. Clad in a garment of roughly woven dark red cloth was a being no taller than her. The odor, she assumed, came from the cloth. The creature's limbs and torso were covered by the cloak. Its feet did not project beyond the hem of the floor-length garment, as would a Kieran's. Arising from the neck area were a number of cloth flaps and extensions that surrounded what she presumed was a head. All she could tell about the face, if it had one, was that projecting from its lower part were two tusks or fangs, one on each side. "Brahms!" came the guttural sound from the creature. It struck its breast with an arm, and the many flaps fluttered and trembled. "Brahms!" it repeated. Turning, it extended the arm toward its companion, waiting in the dark.
"Boros,"
it said, and the second one grunted. Then the first, which remained beneath the hole, tilted its head upward toward the light. Flaps and strips over the face fell back, and Deliani examined it with morbid interest. It was smooth and starkly white, appearing almost to glow in the dim illumination. What she presumed were two eyes were tightly closed, as if to avoid light. But they appeared huge, the skin around them deeply creased. Beneath them was a slight protrusion with two wide nostrils, and it was, through this organ, Deliani assumed, she had been sniffed. The mouth was short and straight, a tusk protruding from each corner. The creature held this position for a time, for no other reason, thought Deliani, than to allow me to see it. When it lowered its head, she thought she saw its eyes open slightly and squint at her through the flaps. The being turned to its counterpart and made a few sounds, motioning it forward. In the light, its appearance was similar to the others. The two bent over and grasped the stone plug from the ceiling, and with an ease that startled the Kirin, hoisted it off the ground, then lifted it up and overhead. Then the creature, who apparently referred to itself as Brahms, gradually released its grasp on the weighty object until its companion was holding it up alone. Finally, to Deliani's amazement, Brahms squatted down and lifted the other being off the ground, the stone still held aloft. When directly beneath the hole, the creature elevated the plug and maneuvered it into the exact position from which it had come. To Deliani's regret, because the next action shut out all light, the stone was tamped back into place by an instrument she never had the opportunity to see. Darkness returned after all too brief a respite of light. Her wrists were grasped, but not with the same firmness, and she was drawn away. After a short trek, they stopped, and she was released. Further shuffling and deep-throated conversation were heard. Then came a welcome sight, light again, but this time from a low-burning flame, one of the beings, she thought it was Brahms, was conveying toward her. Protecting its eyes from the dim light with a forearm, the creature held the small flame out to her. Knowing not when, where, or how it had been ignited, she gladly took an object whose tip gave off a thin, pale glow, the beings apparently knowing she required light. Wondering whether the sounds the creature uttered earlier were names, with this act of kindness she tried again to communicate. "Thank you, Brahms," she said in the home dialect, then Ruvan. Staring between cloth strips through eyes opened slightly, the being tilted its head as though listening. "Will you help me?" asked Deliani in both languages. She explained who she was and that she wished to return to the Shilato cave. The creature turned and conversed with its counterpart in their alien, guttural tongue. Motioning to her, they moved off down the tunnel, and she had no choice but to follow. Soon they entered an enlargement in the passageway, so large she couldn't see the walls with her meager flickering torch. Several more of the beings were there, protecting their eyes from her light, yet studying her, low mutterings coming from all around. The one she thought to be Brahms approached with a glittering object. Shading its eyes, the creature handed it to her and indicated with grunts and gestures it somehow belonged with the torch. She rotated it in her hand. It was funnel-shaped and crudely fashioned from shiny metal, and all at once she knew what to do. She slid it over the flame with the funnel's open end upward, which hid the fire from the creatures but allowed light to be directed toward a low ceiling. The beings made throaty groans of apparent approval. Many more were arriving, and soon a crowd, with pallid faces and dark red robes, encircled her. Thus far, they have been friendly, thought Deliani, but I sorely wish to communicate with them. She thought of Manet. Now that she had light, she glanced quickly about, but saw no sign of her bird, and worried about what had become of her. "Who are you, and where are we located?" she asked in both languages, receiving no response. The creatures inspected her through eyes open but slits. A commotion occurred on one side. The throng parted, and through the gap came Brahms, whom she thought of as her friend, escorting another being older and more wrinkled than any. The crowd deferred to this one, showing special respect. The white-faced, wrinkled one stopped in front of Deliani, its tusks longer than any others, protruding between narrow cloth strips. Brahms cuffed the old one on the shoulder and said,
"Zillerud!"
When the old one spoke, it had the same gruff voice as the others, but this time, to Deliani's astonishment and relief, the words were in Ruvan, the ancient Kirin tongue.
"Welcome, home of Grinkla!"
Chapter 44.
"Zillerud name, what your?"
said the wrinkled creature.
"My name is Deliani," said the Kirin in Ruvan, hoping she was answering the question being asked. Encouraged, she could apparently talk with the beings. "My home is very far. I am on a long journey with companions. They are in the Shilato Kirin's cave." She paused. "I hope my friends are there. I wish to go there, but I don't know where it is. I have been lost in these tunnels in the dark. It's important I go as soon as possible. Can you help me?" Shading its face from the Kirin's meager flame, the old one looked at her with eyes barely open. They were huge, many times the size of Kirin eyes. "These beings," thought Deliani, "live and see in the dark." Having never imagined anything like them, she had no idea what they were thinking or what their intentions might be, and could only hope they would remain friendly. To the best of her knowledge, they had rescued her.
"Show Grigla cave," said Zillerud.
Off the wrinkled one went, in the same fashion it had come, barging through the crowd, a pathway forming before it. "Wait," called Deliani, not knowing whether a single word of hers had been understood. The old one stopped and looked back, protecting its eyes. They all did whenever they glanced in the Kirin's direction or at the dimly lit ceiling. "I came into the tunnel with a companion," said the Kirin, "a bird, a raven. She was with me on the promontory over the water before I was brought here. Do you know where she is?" The wrinkled Zillerud stood silently, apparently turning these words over in its mind, as if not hearing anything like them for a very long time. It looked at Brahms and spoke in throaty tones. The sounds were abrupt, coarse, and strongly emphasized. Brahms responded in kind, and a gruff and energetic exchange followed. Straining to understand, Deliani could fathom not a syllable. Zillerud turned to the Kirin.
"Bird safe. Not here. We keep. Show Grigla cave."
The wrinkled one turned on its heel and strode away, followed closely by Brahms and several others. Taken by the wrist by the one she thought was Boros, Deliani was escorted after the others. She carried the dim torch in her other hand, shadowy light reflecting off the rugged stone roof as they moved briskly along. The small group pressed ahead, the rest of the throng following haphazardly. The Kirin was ushered through a series of underground chambers, all without light save her small flame. They varied in size and shape and included corridors, echoing caverns, and dingy lairs occupied by these unusual creatures. Many smaller grottos were obviously dwelling places, and a few large caves appeared to be for gatherings. Much the same, thought Deliani, as our gathering place on Rogalanon. But she had no idea what some areas were used for, and throughout the tour had no opportunity to question Silarud, the only one she had communicated with. In many places, to her displeasure, were bare skeletons of beings of various breeds and origins, strewn on the floors of passageways, caverns, and dens. Some remains were large, some small. Some were virtually intact, still articulated, while many bones lay by themselves or were thrown into heaps. More fearful by the moment for her own well-being and Manet's, Deliani examined the bones as closely as she could as she was escorted hastily by. She knew they came from birds and animals, but couldn't always tell what species, and the Griglas paraded by them as if they weren't there. "This is most certainly a meat-eating race," she thought nervously. She could not discern how fresh or ancient these bony relics were, and shuddered to think some might be from Kirin's. Having gone, as far as she could tell, throughout the entire residence, the procession stopped in a large cavern, Silarud positioning itself before the crowd. 100 or more are here, thought Deliani, but judging by the extent of the residence, it would appear many more live here, or did in the past. The old one then delivered a speech in the creature's explosive tongue. When it stopped, most of the beings disbanded, sauntering off in various directions. Deliani was led away again, accompanied by Silarud, Brahms, Boros, and a few others who had been in the lead group during the excursion. The Kirin was ushered into a small chamber with a high ceiling and immediately noted a pungent odor. Having never smelled it before, it was distinctly unpleasant. In the middle of the room was a low structure, circular, flat on top, and rough, appearing to be made of a dark-colored metal. On its surface were pieces of what looked like flesh, searing and smoking, being heated by an unknown source, the penetrating smell obviously coming from them. The torch was taken from Deliani's hand, and she watched anxiously as it was placed on the floor at the edge of the room. To her relief, it wasn't extinguished and shed enough light for her to see her surroundings dimly. Boros, Brahms, and others sat down on the floor around the low structure, Silarud opposite where Deliani stood. She was then forcibly seated between two beings and with her long feet noted the metallic structure's warmth. "We're sitting around a cooking platform," she surmised. "Fuel burning inside, out of the vision of these light-fearing creatures." One of the smoking pieces was transferred to the space in front of her. "Eat," said the wrinkled one sharply. Deliani had not eaten for a very long time, not since the breakfast in her guest room in the cave. Though starving, never in her life had she tasted meat, nor had any of her clan. So strong was their bond with animals and birds, and so distasteful the idea of consuming their flesh. Reaching out a hand, she touched the piece of meat. It was warm. Grasping it with both hands, she broke off a small fragment and brought it to her nose. The odor was stifling. Glancing about, she saw the creatures devouring the material, but also watching her through huge, squinting eyes. Despite her hunger and desire to please her captors, she couldn't place the singed flesh in her mouth and hesitantly returned it to the heated surface.
"You eat," said Silarud.
Picking up the small fragment, Deliani tried a second time, but the odor caused a wave of nausea, and she put it down in front of her. Silarud turned and conversed briefly with Brahms, then looked at the Kirin and spoke, now less harshly.
"Not eat long time. Eat now, strong."
Hoping not to offend these beings, Deliani tried to explain herself. "I'm sorry, but I have never eaten the flesh of an animal or bird, cooked or otherwise. I am hungry and would like to eat your food, but I cannot." Silarud eyed her inquisitively, then said,
"You like Shultam, not eat animal."
The wrinkled one glanced at Brahms, and they engaged in a lively conversation, Boros and the others joining in until Silarud looked back at Deliani.
"But you different from Shultam. Smell same but talk different. Wear different clothes. What eat?"
"Almost anything from the forest," said the Kirin. "Honey, berries, seeds, mushrooms, clover, nuts, almost anything but meat." Glancing at the others, Silarud said a few words in their harsh tongue. Though not finished with their meal, all but the wrinkled one rose and filed out of the room without a word, each taking whatever morsels were left in front of them. Alone with the tribe's obvious leader, Deliani didn't know what to expect.
Kirin's The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
To learn more about Kirin's, visit www.kirinbooks.com.
You have been listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.